From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, Bay Area-based journalist Meredith Marin has written a book about the period when thousands believed through hypnosis, drugs, or overzealous therapists that they were recovering memories of childhood molestation. Her book, My Lie, A True Story of False Memory, is a searing account of the cases that were all too common in that period, including her own story of accusing her father of a molestation that she realized, after causing great pain and division within her family, never took place. Meredith Marin joins us in studio for the hour ahead with your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Award-winning Bay Area journalist Meredith Marin joins us in studio for this Forum Hour to discuss the siege of abuse stories that proliferated in the 80s and 90s during a phase that saw literally tens of thousands believing they had succeeded in recovering repressed childhood memories of sexual abuse. The McMartin preschool case is perhaps the best remembered and most notorious case, but there were other serious and family-shattering cases, including fathers being sent to prison, and there were all too many cases of parents being charged with molestation that broke up families and went unreported, even by those like Meredith Marin, who wrote steadily about the subject and the families involved and accused her own father of molestation. Now she's brought out a book about her accusations against her once adored father and the painful consequences that resulted and the subsequent pain-filled recognition of the falseness of the accusations. The author of Dirty, Class Dismissed, and What It's Like to Live Now, her new book is called My Lie, A True Story of False Memory. Meredith Marin joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and welcome.
Great to be here, Michael.
Yeah, good to have you here. In reading your book, I was thinking about the well, you mentioned a couple of times the book by Ellen Bass and Laura Davis,
right.
The Courage to Heal, and it was like scripture. And so were many of these notions that if you think you were abused, you were or sexually molested, you were. If children make that accusation, then children don't lie and so forth.
There Believe was, the children.
But yeah, but there really was a kind of absoluteness about this as far as the faith and belief in these, what I'm almost calling a credo.
That's right. And, you know, to jump right ahead to the big picture of the book, or the reason that I really wanted to write the book, there's something about certainty that is in itself now suspect to me. And, you know, I had this experience during the 08 campaign when those people would go to the McCain rallies and scream about Obama being a Muslim and killing people off at the death panels and so on. And people with me would be saying, what is wrong with those people? How can those people be so crazy? And I would sit there and think, that was me. I was that crazy.
Well, it was startling to me during that period because I had these debates and I had people like you who believed they were molested and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I remember even Roseanne Barr coming out and saying, I remember
right.
when I was 6 months old, my father, how could she remember
yeah.
when she's 6 months
right.
old? But we also had people like Richard Offshee and mm-hmm. Frederick Cruz who said, the difficulty with traumatic memories is getting rid of them.
Right.
I mean, like chowchilla, that sort of thing.
Right. I wish I could forget. Many sexual
exactly.
abuse survivors have said, if only there
so
were a drug
it,
for this.
It
yeah.
never seemed to equate in that way, though. I mean, somehow, like you were a true believer, really, weren't you?
I was. And I think that I sort of brainwashed myself. Again, big picture of this book, I want to make it clear at the outset that although I definitely feel I would not have made this particular accusation against my father if absent this mania in the culture, I also feel it's true that, you know, I did this. This is something I did myself. So it's a very delicate balance to, on the one hand, take responsibility for something that I personally did that was the worst thing I've ever done in my life, and then to also mention and discuss in the book the fact that so many other people did it as well, and to look for reasons that are both personal and political and sort of spiritual and sociological. It's delicate because it can easily tilt into letting myself off the hook, and it can easily tilt into who is this, you know, psycho who just made up this story about her dad.
Well, in fact, when you said brainwashed, I immediately turned to your book where you're talking to a friend named Catherine, and you say, do you think we were brainwashed? I wondered aloud, or did we brainwash ourselves?
Exactly.
And that's maybe still one of those questions that you don't have the answer for. But there are certainly a lot of indicators here. I mean, you went out as a journalist. You heard these stories. You heard of these monstrous men who really did molest children, their daughters and their sons. And you empathize with them. I'm talking about the real victims now.
Right, right. Before there were recovered memory false accusations, there was a growing awareness in the late 70s, early 80s, thanks to the feminist researchers, of the fact that incest was not as it had been believed to be, this total fluke and rarity. And again, referring back to our friends in the Tea Party, I sort of became an evangelist because I edited a book for one of those feminist researchers. I saw these statistics of studies unlike any that had been done before. One in three American women was walking around with memories of sexual abuse.
Those were the numbers. It sounded crazy even to me at the time. They said one out of three women and one out of 10 men. And I thought, where do they come up with these numbers?
Well, where they came up with that number was one of the studies went door to door in San Francisco, random sample, knocked on 1,000 doors and asked women a series of questions about their childhoods. And these, we were not then talking about repressed memories or recovered memories. We were talking about women who said, oh, yes, when I was a child, my father touched me inappropriately, or he raped me, or my uncle, or the janitor at school.
Or I think somebody might have done something
to me. Well, you know, those early studies, that was not how they were reported. Now, whether that woman, I wasn't in the room, I wasn't at the kitchen door, I don't know what they were actually saying, but that's how it came across. One in three American women.
But you also had dreams, and you put a lot of stock in your dreams, nightmares maybe even, and maybe wanted to be a victim. Plus, you were coming out as a lesbian, and you were involved in a relationship with a woman who was convinced that she had been involved in satanic rituals
right.
and so forth. So this is really multifactorial, I mean, in terms of your own experience.
The perfect storm. And, you know, you could take my story and then go ask someone else who's a quote-unquote retractor. It's good to have a label. I don't have a PhD.
Retractors, but we should say, are those who made the charge and then retracted it.
And then retracted it. And the quote-unquote character, a friend of mine, Catherine, you mentioned earlier, she and I reconnected after all these years. We had been counselors together working on our incest memories. And then I called her up 20 years later and said, so all those things you were saying were true then, are they true? And she said, no. And that's that kind of conversation was what got the book going.
You also had a very curious relationship with your father in that you adored him when you were young. You felt that you were more bonded to him certainly than you were to your mother in many ways. And then the love kind of went away and you felt maybe betrayed and abandoned because he wasn't as loving toward you, although I think he always loved you, reading between the lines here, and vice versa. But there was a sense that maybe he just didn't love you enough. He didn't accept you for your lesbianism. I mean, all that really played in too, didn't it?
There were a lot of factors, psychological as well as social, for sure. What specifically happened, and this was number 27 on the list of symptoms that I was keeping in my incest journal, was the fact that it was when I became a sexual being that my father and I had our big rupture. And that's when he became very possessive and didn't like any of my boyfriends. And I actually felt like I had to choose between having a sexual life with boys my age or having my life with my father. And I left home very young, in part because of these pitched battles we were having every time a boy came to pick me up.
And then when you started seeing this woman, Jane, who became one of your early partners and who believed that she had undergone satanic abuse and so forth, your father didn't approve. And he said, in fact, that your sons didn't approve. So there was all of that kind of coming down on you, really, wasn't it?
Right. My father said that he would never accept her as part of our family after we had been together 3 years. And he had actually hung out with her some with my kids and never said anything. But when it came to a family dinner, he said she will never be a part of this family and uninvited her to a family dinner. And then that sort of instigated a huge fight and that began our estrangement.
This wasn't like the phenomenon where people thought they were being taken aboard flying saucers and penetrated.
Really?
And so
how
forth.
Was it different?
well, in this sense. I mean, it may be the same in terms of the confabulation and the imagining that these things happen and feeling traumatic under hypnosis and going through the whole experience
right.
and so forth. But there weren't that many people who believed in those kinds of things outside of those people who felt they experienced them. Whereas here, we had what almost seemed like a social movement and a gospel, as I said earlier. And who was held culpable or accountable for spreading this gospel? I mean, you talk about, you know, courage to heal and all of these therapists.
Right.
Charlatans, too. Mm-hmm. Right?
Well, you know, you have to take into account the sort of chronology and the history of what happened. And you can't, you know, we have a tendency in this country, we have kind of an ADHD version of our own history. But, you know, before there were feminists saying there were 1 in 3 American women had been molested, there was complete denial of sexual abuse. And before there was denial of sexual abuse, there was, you know, huge inequality between the sexes and domestic violence. And a lot of the feminists who did the research on incest had come from the anti-domestic violence movement. And so it did become a movement. And it was strange bedfellows, because the feminists who had these studies quite quickly became allied with the extreme right-wing sort of family values people who participated very actively together in, particularly in the preschool trials like the McMartin trial. You mentioned. Yes.
We're talking, by the way, with Meredith Marin, who is the author of My Life and the best-selling author of What It's Like to Live Now. And
My Lie.
My
Life. My Life was the first of the first two memoirs.
My Life. I saw the F in there kind of as
you're
a
not the
Freudian
only one to
slip
make the
or something.
Mistake.
Well, it's more than your life. I mean, it's you cover so many. In fact, you cover a case that many people may remember that happened up in Napa as a journalist, and obviously kept good notes, and you have a lot of sort of Dos Passos news clips here from things that happened during that period. And I wanted to talk with you about some of these cases in general. But you do come clean with a great deal of remorse and guilt that you feel. And I'm looking at the first email that comes in here and says, I mean this question respectfully. It's from a listener in Berkeley. Russell says, why should we believe what you're saying right now?
Exactly. Why should you? Yes. I mean, how do we know what we should believe? That is certainly a valid question. And in titling the book, that definitely was relevant. But the book is meant to be provocative, and the book is meant to encourage the reader to think about what he or she knows is true and to kind of go with the gut. So I would say, Russell, listen on. Would be very interested to hear if by the end of the hour you feel that I'm a reliable narrator of my own story.
Well, you said about your own father that he lacked the cruelty to crush a spider, and yet these accusations, you also say, wrecked your family and divided your family and denied your children a grandfather that they loved and so forth. I mean, the guilt is pretty heavy. And what do you do about that? How do you exorcise it?
Well, exercise. I understand what you're saying. Maybe you have someone on staff. It's been a process. I have to say it was harder living with this mistake, this wrong that I committed in the 10 years after I apologized, but before I really went to my father and he was willing to hear me really talk to him about what had happened. Because when we initially reconciled, the condition of our reconciliation was pretty much that we wouldn't talk about it. And 10 years later, he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And
what a sad irony. You recovered your real memory and he loses his.
He loses his, yes. We're always linked, my father and me, in some strange way. But when we were able to have that conversation, it made a huge difference in our relationship, for one thing. There's something about doing the worst thing you can think of to do to somebody and having that person forgive you in a thorough way, not just by saying, you know, let's just forget it ever happened. Let's just go on, which we did. But it always felt very hollow to me. And now it feels very rich and full.
How do your sons react to this story? You have grown sons, right?
Yeah, they're adult, yes. Well, it was my sons and my niece and nephew, I think, my brother's kids, who really paid the hardest price. All four of them were very close when they were very young and used to spend a lot of time with my father, their grandfather, together. And all of a sudden, when they were still quite young, 5, 6, 7, 8, my kids were no longer allowed to go to their grandfather's house. And so the four cousins were really separated at a time that was very painful for them then and continues to affect their relationship. And I think of all the things I feel worst about, that's pretty much it.
When did, what was it really that turned you around? I mean, to realize that there was no scientific proof of recovered memory, which now is almost a foregone conclusion, but.
Well, actually, I want to stop you there, if you don't mind. I actually believe in recovered memory, and I've been misunderstood a few times already. It's only, book's only been out a couple of days, and I've already got long lists of factual errors to be expected. But,
I did get the impression in reading the book that you were no longer a believer.
Yeah,
as
so
a retractor,
my bad. My lie, my bad. What can I say? I do believe that it's possible to forget something and recall it later. You mean
trauma or molestation?
Or where your keys are.
Quite a divide between those.
Quite a divide, but there is the question, does the phenomenon exist? Can you forget something and then pull it up from memory again.
Forget things all the time.
Right. But you're saying, does trauma cause
memory was, in this context that we're talking about, meant to be a memory that had been buried or repressed
right.
so deeply that you needed hypnosis or something
right.
to bring it back.
Right. And so one of the things I learned from my own experience and then writing the book about my own experience is not to give categorical answers about things to which the answer is, I don't know. And I've had some letters from people who have said, I had a piece on Salon a couple of days ago, and lots of letters, and quite a few of them said, I am a person who now knows that I was molested as a child, and I lost that memory for 10 years or 20 years, and now I have it again. Far be it from me to say that's not the case.
Well, I appreciate your uncertainty. sometimes the certainty of uncertainty is can be very heartening. I alluded to the Gary Ramona case and his daughter Holly before, and you covered that.
Yes.
What was the outcome? I mean, what is the outcome now? Have you kept up with these kinds of cases? And maybe talk a bit about the case because
listeners
may not
know. Yeah, okay. So Gary Ramona was and now it still is in some way a wine executive in Napa. And his daughter, Holly, accused him of molesting her very severely. She claimed that she had forgotten it for a long time, most of her life, and that it had ended when she was 16 and that she remembered it when she was in college and was struggling with eating issues. And her therapist said, you know, a lot of people with bulimia were sexually abused. Do you think that happened to you? So she first accused him publicly, and he was a very public figure in the wine community in Napa. Her mother and sisters believed Holly, and the mother divorced the father, and the family was completely ripped asunder. And I don't remember now if she took him to court, but the trial I covered was his trial.
He took her to court.
He took her to court. Right. And that's the trial that I covered.
And the resolution of that?
Her therapist, I believe, was charged. And I can't, again, I'm going to resort to that hardly honest answer. I don't remember the details of the resolution, but I do remember the trial very well. And it was the most excruciating courtroom thing I've ever seen.
I wasn't there, but reading the narrative of it was, I remember, even painful. And yet, how many therapists, I mean, there are people who went to jail, there are people who use this for custody battles and so forth.
To this day.
How much accountability was there? How much justice was rendered, really?
It's food for thought, I would say. I personally am not a consumer of traditional therapy anymore, and I hope that stays that way. But I also really encourage people who feel like it helps them, and I just say to you, please be careful. You know, it's your mind, it's your memories, it's your experience, and the best therapy will just give you access to that and not lay anything on you.
Well, there are enough real stories, you know, with priests and Mormon church girls and girl in Austria and so forth,
right.
Lurid and horrible,
right.
That these kind of confabulated and manufactured stories in some ways may have diminished the real stories.
Well, that's one of the accusations that I've heard in response to my book. You know, there are people who really were molested and feel completely betrayed that, you know, I'm
a survivor, a victim too. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not saying I'm a victim. And I deal with that in the book because when I interviewed, I left about 90% of my interviews on the cutting room floor when I wrote the book. Several of the people I interviewed were people who either are still in jail today and are believed to be falsely accused or have been released from prison or are still living as registered sex offenders. One, a woman with whom I became quite close, and I was telling her about what I was doing, and she said, you know, you have to realize you're a victim too, because, you know, you were malpractice was practiced upon you, and, you know, it's not your fault that all these people were thinking the same thing at the same time. And I told her I respectfully disagreed with her. I don't feel I was a victim. I do feel I was affected. As I said earlier, I don't believe I would have made this accusation absent the cultural mania, but I'm a big girl, and I was a big girl then, and I made some really, really bad decisions.
Now, you've taken the mantle of responsibility, obviously. You also went and talked to Elizabeth Loftus when you became an attractor, which you thought you would never do.
Right.
She was the enemy, really, wasn't she?
Yeah. I mean, I very much experienced myself as being sort of in a double cult in the 80s, which was, in the first place, becoming sort of an evangelist to get out this important statistic that one in three American women had been molested. And in telling the true stories of these little girls whose therapy sessions I sat in the 80s, and the perpetrators whose therapy sessions I sat in on, and I believe gave myself a little case of PTSD with that. But, you know, it's... It is a matter of knowing where the net benefit and where the net loss is. And I still believe, and I will, I'm sure, hear about it, I still believe, and I discuss this in the book, that with everything that happened and the personal damage that I inflicted and others inflicted, we now have an awareness of children's rights and the dangers to children that is far superior to what we had when I started writing incest articles in 1983. And I, for one, am glad that my children had that training in first grade. And I do believe that there are, you know, I'm not sure that there's less child molestation, but I think there's less of it going unacknowledged.
Well, there's more awareness, certainly, that's for sure.
And unfortunately, there were extremes and excesses and horrible mistakes made.
When did you sort of move toward a retractor? Was there something that really triggered that, or an incident or an episode?
Again, a perfect storm. It was a matter of, you know, it took me about 5 years of wondering if my father had molested me before I made the accusation. And it took me about 2 years, I would say, to come to a place of beginning with doubt and then with, you know, some degree of certainty that it wasn't true.
Well, you're certain about neuroscience now, at least if you read your book, it seems like you are.
I was curious about it because the first question that popped up into my mind was if I wondered right now whether my father had molested me, and I went and got an fMRI, the latest technology, or a PET scan, would they be able to tell me certainly that I had or I had not, or that I was lying or that I was telling the truth? And so I did a bunch of interviews with neuroscientists to sort of try to answer that question. It's very interesting.
Well, it's all in the book, My Lie by Meredith Marin. And we invite you to join this conversation if you have something you'd like to contribute, if you have a question or comment, perhaps some experiences that you can bring to the table here. By all means, feel free to join us. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, the number to call, toll-free, is 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your calls, and you can call now, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or you can put a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is Meredith Marin here with us in studio. Her book is My Lie, A True Story of False Memory. And she'll be at Berkeley Arts and Letters at the Hillside Club, Cedar and Spruce, this evening. She'll be introduced by Ayelet Waldman and John McMurtry of the San Francisco Chronicle. A book editor will be in conversation with her at 7:30, and that's an event that's open to the public.
Correct.
There'll be wine and dessert, so feel free to attend. In the meantime, let's attend to your calls, and we'll begin, Damien, with you. Good morning.
Good morning, and great show. You know, Ms. Maringer, when I first heard you that you accused your dad, I have to admit I was very angry that you would do such a thing to your father. And as a father myself, I can just imagine the heartbreak that he had. But the second thing is that the book is actually a good thing. And my question is with regard to the current use of child molestation charges on in divorce cases. Do you think that your book might have a positive impact in deterring that false accusation? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, we thank you for the call.
Thanks, and thanks for your disclosure. I realize it's hard to feel sympathy for someone who does what I did. You know, a girl can dream. I hope that the book does all kinds of things. I definitely hope that it discourages judges from believing lies in the courtroom. I hope it discourages parents who are warring over child custody from using that weapon because it actually hurts the kids more than it hurts anyone else. I hope that children who are being abused will be encouraged by aware adults around them to pay attention to their needs. And I hope that it will encourage people who tell lies in their everyday lives not to do that, to use their words and talk about their feelings and say, you know, I really hate having a black president, instead of saying Obama's a Muslim, or say, you know, Dad, I need some time off from you because we're too enmeshed, instead of saying, Dad, you molested me. So, yes, I hope that the book will do good on a number of fronts.
There's also a lesson that comes, a lot of lessons that come through in this book along the lines that you're outlining. But in addition to the remorse and guilt that you felt over all the damage you did to your family and so forth and hurting your father, there's one moment where you just say, what a waste of time.
Right.
And I mean, there's I think, a good piece of wisdom in that, that people can get caught up in these sort of psychodramas or whatever you want to call them and waste an enormous amount of time.
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't stop any of us from being jerks to the people we love. But whenever I'm being a jerk to someone I love, I think it's not enough. There's not enough damage and disease and war and everything else in the world. Like, we have to do this to each other.
We'll bring in more callers and we'll go next to Lynn in Berkeley. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Seven. And when I first came out and said that I had been abused, I'm one of the Mormon girls you referenced earlier. No one was talking at all. It was an enormous taboo. And I'd just like to kind of address the fact that when women or young girls come out and say something that's true, that you see the ramifications, which are just awful. And it's really common on seeing.
We've got something wrong with her cell phone there, but I think you get the gist of what she's bringing up here.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the statistics on this, how much more likely a child is to be believed now than 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or 50 years ago. One can only hope it improves.
Well, you know, I had some abuse when I was younger. I write about it in my new book, just briefly, but I just felt for many years I had to keep it hidden. It wasn't sexual abuse. It was physical abuse, but it was pretty bad from a teacher. And I was a kid who acted up and acted out, and so I thought I was a bad boy.
Right, you deserved it.
Which I was,
yeah.
So I couldn't tell my parents because they would, and years later they said, why couldn't you have told us? You know, I mean, they were appalled that I, and so unhappy that I hadn't. But there was always that sense of, you know, not wanting to be a victim. I mean,
right.
And what you write about are so many people. That was the last thing I wanted, you know, to create pity for myself or from other people. And yet, I think that's a lot of what's going on here.
I agree. I mean, the crowning irony of this story to me was that this epidemic came out of a social movement whose stated goal was to empower women, to keep women from being victims. And in the course of getting there, somehow we had to all flock like lemmings to the sea of victimhood. There was this sisterhood, this extension of sisterhood, from sisterhood is powerful to sisterhood is being an incest survivor.
It's almost why one of the reasons why I admired Camille Paglia, because she would say things like, when women were waking up the next morning and in some instances feeling that they had experienced abuse or they were molested or this kind of thing, and she said in so many instances they were casting themselves, there were many instances that were legitimate, absolutely. I mean, let's put that out front because it's so obvious. But in many instances, it was like, I'm a victim again and wanting to be seen as a victim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what she said was the empowering that feminism was supposed to provide.
Right. And I also think that, again, looking at history, there was a time in our history it's not quite over when the solution for everything is therapy. You know, on the one hand, and I talk about this in the book, other cultures have other ways of dealing with psychic and emotional and spiritual pain, and we don't have those things here. And that combined, you know, it's sort of a cocktail of believing so much that it can be fixed, any kind of pain can be fixed, and believing that we shouldn't have any, that pain is always something to be fixed. And you take those things and then, you know, throw in therapy. And it was a time when going to therapy was seen as an empowering act in itself, because we're, you know, taking responsibility for our own orgasms, and now we're taking responsibility for our own, you know, psychic pain.
And you can also find out, there was a kind of notion that it was a panacea, you could find out the mysteries of your own psyche.
Exactly.
And what you had hidden and what you had repressed. And sometimes it's better off leaving them buried, even when they're real. Let me go to more of your calls here. Christine, hi, join us. You're on.
Hi, thank you. I have not taken back my memory of being molested. And I think I have an idea of why I repressed it. And I was molested when I was 6 or 7 by a cousin who lived in the same town, whom our families would visit together often. And it became apparent to me that if I were to tell my parents, that it would kind of ruin the family, that there would be accusations, that I wouldn't be believed. I thought the older, you know, my cousin was 16, that people would, you know, believe him. And I think that I repressed it because there wasn't anything I could do with it. This was, you know, I recovered the memory in 1969. In college, a week after I started having sex with my boyfriend. You know, it seems to me that, I mean, it just sort of arose again. I was not in therapy. It was not during the 80s. But I had to call in and say, I think, apart from trying to figure out, you know, and wonder whether anything happened, I never had to wonder. I couldn't, as a child, deal with that fact.
Did you actually forget it, or did you just not talk about it?
No, I repressed it. I didn't talk about it. I recall thinking at the time, I can't say anything about this. And then I forgot it. And then it came, I don't, you know, forget. I think it was repressed because there wasn't really a way to deal with it.
Right.
And so I just, my feeling is, you know, this was, nobody was involved. Nobody was suggesting anything. I never talked to the person about it. I didn't sue him. I never accused him. You know, nothing. But I did need to deal with, you know, with my mistrust of men. I mean, it does take a toll and you do have to deal with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I guess I just really, you know, it's important to me, because of my experience, to have people understand that while I completely agree with you, I mean, there was all this mayhem, and it was crazy, and people were making up a lot of stuff. There are circumstances where people repress things when they're in a position where they can't really deal with it. That doesn't mean it stays repressed. But so I just really felt like I wanted to share that.
I'm glad you did, Christine, and I thank you for
thank
the call.
You.
In fact, here's a listener named Dan who says, this may be obvious, but I can't help comparing this to the Salem witch trials. Well, this is from Scott, who says, right out of the gate, the guest tries to tie the notion of certainty to the Tea Party movement. She obviously has not learned anything. Notice the jocular way she tells her story. Oh, gee, my bad. Oh, gee, look at all the lives we ruined. Oh, well, at least she had good intentions. The recovered memory was liberal fanaticism run amok. Another listener says, whoops, sorry, Dad, I think I'll write a book and make some money to draw my guilt. Now, you've been getting these kind of responses.
I sure have.
Yeah. I mean, enmity, hostility, you can understand it. Here's a listener who says, are there any credible cases of actual molestation victims who also have had false memories added on top of? I dealt with a woman once who started with a credible accusation of a family's friends once having interfered with her, who after years of therapy knew that it was actually her father who had repeatedly molested her, sometimes in the presence of many family members. On the whole, much less credible. The non-malicious implantation of false memories in the course of treatment is not as bad as child molestation. I find it hard to understand how some people who are willing to believe that the world is bad enough that the one can happen, but not the other. And another listener writes, so this is false testimony. How does this differ from all the wrongly accused that have been defended by the Innocence Project? What consequences have the accusers, the inquisitors, suffered? We'll go to more calls. Charles, join us. Hi.
Hi. I'm in my 80s now, but when I was in my 30s, I was divorced, and I was given custody of two daughters. And to this day, one of my daughters, my older one, really treats me very, very poorly. I was wondering, she has never accused me of anything like this, but she often makes up lies about other things. And I was wondering what it is that caused you to make up these lies about sexual molestation.
Well, thanks for calling in, and I'm really sorry about you and your daughter. And I think I've kind of said what, you know, the combination of psychological factors, wanting a relationship with my father that I didn't have, and, you know, and the culture kind of running amok, as one of the writers said. I think the important thing is that we get really hung up on stories, whether the story is a particular accusation of a particular crime or whether the story is how we've been wronged by someone else. And what's really hard to do is to sort of hear, in your case, that your daughter is in pain or that she's angry, to be able to sit with that and express to her how much you want to understand her pain and her suffering and her anger, and at the same time not admit to things, of course, that aren't true. It's a very delicate dance, and I wish you great luck with it.
Yeah, good luck to you, and thank you, Charles, for your call. You often refer to being in planet incest, and I mean, that's how you describe it, where so many women, particularly women, shared this kind of commiseration and,
right,
and empathy for each other and their experiences. I wondered to what extent, again, I go back to that first, that early lesbian relationship with that woman named Jane, wanting to identify with her and maybe even wanting to compete with her on some level.
I think wanting to be her hero. You know, when I met her, I had been an incest reporter, quote unquote, for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years at that point. And I felt in the same way as I discuss in the book. When the Vietnam War was happening, I'm 59 years old, so I was in high school when the Vietnam War was happening, and I was very active in opposing the war. And every night we would go to sleep with these images, I would, in my head, of little girls being burned with napalm. And I felt like that napalm is being dropped on that little girl in my name. And I became, you know, very emotional about trying to stop that from happening. And it was a very similar situation when I started doing this incest work. The reporting work, not the personal work. And I felt similarly with these little girls I would meet whose fathers had raped them and who had lived with that for maybe years until they disclosed it to their mothers. I felt I was their voice and I wanted to be their advocate. And so then I...
Maybe you wanted to be them.
well, maybe. You know, the upside is that unlike a generically unhappy family, a family in which incest is happening and in which treatment is happening, the kids are getting what one hopes is good attention from well-meaning adults.
Leslie, join us. Welcome to Forum. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I was just calling in because I couldn't help have an emotional reaction to this particular segment. And from someone who was raped as a young teenager, I do find this a little infuriating that, although I don't want anyone to be wrongly accused, so many men do these horrific things that do go unprosecuted, and I feel that this might be detrimental to that situation. I, of course, didn't repress the memory. I was taken to the emergency room immediately after, but it was just, I do find this a little upsetting.
I don't totally understand how you feel, and it's one of the, you know, one of the dangerous things about publishing a book on this topic. So I understand, and thanks for your call.
Thank you for calling in, Leslie, and we'll go to another caller, and that's you, Dan. Hi, thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Yes, sir, you're on the air.
I have two comments and a question. The first one is I want to illuminate the economic path. Every professional involved, psychs, attorneys, everybody, makes one heck of a lot more money once this messy problem's on the table. And the individuals who are accused, whether this goes to trial or not, are treated as if it is the case, and all of the treatment is then purchased. It's thousands and thousands of dollars to psychs who control it. thousands and thousands of dollars to monitors who control it. They determine whether they want the money or not. Nobody solves this problem fast. And almost 100% of these are acted upon. So it's a foregone conclusion. Everybody makes a ton of money, and all the professionals involved want it. And the judge, who's more friends with those professionals than the content of the files, tends to let it go down the path of spending a ton of money. The other comment I would like to make is there's no benefit for any of these professionals to say it didn't happen, because if later it found out that it was, then they're legally liable and there's a problem there. So 100% of the time, it's acted on as if it was the case, and now we're discovering, oh my gosh, now we have false memories. And there's a good book by Richard Gardner, False Accusation and Molestation Accusations. I think I got the title wrong. But my question is, have you read that book? Do you, are you familiar with the work of Richard Gardner, and how do you think that the economics played into your circumstance of allowing this to occur?
Well, thanks for the question. I have read Richard Gardner, and I want to actually disagree with a few things that you've said. First of all, in my personal case, the therapist I saw during the time I was trying to decide whether I had been molested or trying to recover memories were very neutral, as it happens, and did not lead me in any specific direction. When I came in saying I think my father molested me, they sat there and listened to that. When I said I thought he didn't, they listened to that. And so I was lucky in that sense. There definitely were therapists who were sort of going on fishing expeditions. But I do want to point out that although in many ways my book is a condemnation of irresponsible therapy, it is not a condemnation of responsible therapy. And I happen to know a lot of therapists who are very high integrity human beings. I also want to mention that I do agree with you very much that this is a follow the money situation. It's not just the therapists who make more money if you are digging for sexual abuse than if you go in there and they say, you know, I think you're fine, or here, have some Prozac. But what's also true is there were hundreds and hundreds of legal cases in which experts and lawyers were paid huge amounts of money. There were huge amounts of settlements, sometimes exceeding in the millions of dollars, settlements to clients whose therapists were found to have guilty of malpractice, settlements to children whose preschool teachers had allegedly molested them, etc. So this is a huge money story, and you're absolutely right about that.
And because it was so in vogue, to use that phrase, right, it generated a great deal of greed, and there was a great deal of money to be made.
That's right.
It was like, you know, a gold rush as far as repressed memories.
That's right.
Here's a listener named Joe in Oakland who says, I always enjoy the variety of your guests, Michael, and the subject matter you discuss, but listening to this woman justify and promote her extreme narcissism is too much to condone with listening any further. She was destructive with her initial allegations, and public notice of her clarity only makes matters worse. I look forward to tomorrow's show. Have you been accused of narcissism in writing this book?
I'm not sure I've heard the N-word specifically, but definitely there's a theme running through the negative mail, which is, you know, that I'm profiting from pain that I caused. And as my agent emailed me when she saw some of the letters on Salon, maybe we should tell them exactly what the finances of this project are. Just let's say I'm not making money.
Here's Johanna in response to that last caller. Johanna, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning.
I was calling. I actually am a prosecutor, and I work in a sexual assault unit and prosecute primarily child molest cases, but also adult rape cases, and just wanted to respond to the last comment that 100% of these cases are pursued. That's far from the truth.
Right.
Many of the allegations that are made initially to the police never make it to our office because of lack of corroboration or because they occur in a child custody situation. And then even when they are brought to our office for filing, frequently the cases are not filed because of the same issues. As a prosecutor, we are, you know, bound ethically to only pursue cases where we believe the children are making credible allegations. And frequently, we do require corroboration before we do proceed with prosecution. So I just wanted to correct the fallacy in those last comments about us profiting. I make the same salary whether I win or lose, whether we file charges or not, as do the police and other professionals involved.
How long have you been a prosecutor, Joanna?
For 4 years.
For 4 years. There were, presumably during this period, we're talking about far more of these cases than there are now? Do you know?
There are more. I feel like it's increased with the economic downturn, and I don't know if that's because more people are feeling like they can report or because more people are out of work, at home, with access to children, and are getting into trouble.
Well, we thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Just a quick footnote again on people are saying, well, what about polygraphs? And could you have used a polygraph? And you
right.
were talking about neuroscience machines now and all that.
Right. Yeah. The reason I got onto the neuroscience trail was that there is now new lie detector technology that uses that technology. And I was trying to find out if it could be applied here. It's not accurate enough. I don't think that someone today who's trying to recover memories could go into an fMRI machine and with all accuracy be told, yes, you were or no, you weren't. There are indications of increased activity, increased oxygen to the brain when we lie. So
sometimes people lie and they don't know they're lying, which is why the polygraph is, for most reasons, one of the main reasons, not permissible in court.
And I've also heard that in response to my book. The title is not accurate. It because I believed what I was saying when I said it, and that's not really a lie.
Well, you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Meredith Marin. Her book is My Lie, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And our next caller is from Menlo Park. John, join us. Hi.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just wanted to share with the listening audience and yourselves this seminal book that came out a couple of years ago by Elliot Aronson and Carol Tavares. The title was called Mistakes Were Made,
But Not By Me.
You know, how we justify foolish beliefs, bad decisions, and hurtful acts. And you know, he talks about this, you know, central theme of cognitive dissonance, which came out back from some initial work out of Stanford University with Professor Leon Festinger in the 50s. And through the book, he talks about this one chapter about false memories, and he used the McMartin daycare, you know, story down in Southern California as one example of many where false memories and these instances of, you know, alleged incest or molestation occurred. But then upon further examination, in the light of the latest science in cognitive dissonance and psychology, it really casts a new light on it. So I just wanted to bring that up for the listening audience and, you know, Michael and your guests, if you can just maybe talk about it a little bit.
About?
I mean, you know, your knowledge about cognitive dissonance, you know, the book and how maybe that relates to, you know, the overall, you know, theme that you're talking
right,
about.
Right, right. Well, first of all, a big shout out to Carol Tavares. I did read that book for my research and it's really a fascinating topic. And I think, you know, one of the things, again, going back to neuroscience that I learned from Dr. Robert Burton, who gave me some great interviews for the book, is that the brain physiologically seeks certainty, that when we are sure of something, we get a hit of dopamine, which is, you know, what we love. There's a reason it's called dope. And so that what Carol Tavares' research and Dr. Burton's research and so on is about how much we long to know for sure and how much better it feels to us to be certain of a lie than to be uncertain about a truth. And that was, you know, a big reason that, you know, bringing it back to this story that I did accuse my father, because living with the uncertainty of that and having that project of trying to figure out if I was right or wrong was so all-consuming and so unsatisfying.
Listener John writes, I just wanted to say I totally respect your attempt to make right what came before. I feel your wisdom learned and appreciate your continuing search for the truth.
Having that one bronzed.
You know, it stirs up emotions on both sides, as you well know. We got a caller named Kathy from Durango, Colorado. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am, you're on the air.
Hi, I had an experience and a question. When I was in labor in 1993 with my son, I was going through a prolonged labor with a midwife, and suddenly in the middle of my labor, she looked at me and said, maybe you were molested as a child, why you're having a hard time giving birth.
Oh, my God.
And I said, no, I was not. And she said, are you sure? You probably don't remember.
Ugh.
And it completely changed my attitude towards her. Even today, 17 years later, I feel very resentful that she would say something like that to me in the middle of labor and never had once brought up that topic beforehand.
Well, if you were to believe those statistics, one out of three, then you know, almost everybody having birth, though, at least the 33 1/3%, might have had repressed memories.
Well, that's a horrible, horrible experience to have had, and I'm really sorry that you had to go through
that.
Yeah,
so am I, and I'm glad you called. You had
Thank
a question, though. Yeah. Kathy.
Well, I just wanted to know if she has ever come across anything like that in her research that other women have had experience like that.
Not the particular delight you experienced of having that introduced during labor, although I would doubt that you're the only one, but certainly many, many times more in a therapeutic environment.
Here's a listener who writes, to what extent did religious fundamentalism play into or create the hysteria that you described? The idea of an active devil or Satan and our ability to understand evil in the world as an expression of a satanic intelligence at war with an omniscient God, was this a mainspring behind the recovered memory phenomenon? If so, what does this episode tell us about religious Christian fundamentalism?
Well, that's actually an interesting question. You know, one of the things that made me believe that the first round of sex abuse panic, which had to do with the preschool trials, McMartin and hundreds of others across the country, was that all these 3- and 5-year-old kids were telling the same bizarre stories. And I thought,
of satanic ritual abuse,
right. You know, and I won't go into the details, but then later it was discovered that many of those themes were existing in the Michael Jackson Thriller video.
What a note to end on, but we have come to the end. Meredith, thank you for being with
thank
us.
Thank you, Michael, so
Meredith
much.
Meredith Marin's new book, My Lie, A True Story of False Memory, should be at Berkeley Arts and Letters at the Hillside Club tonight at 7:30. And I thank her for being with us, and thank you, our listeners, because we wouldn't be here without you. And we want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell and Amy Machado. And I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.